Hello, this is Tim Bailey with Jürgen von Hagen. And let me say a couple of things as we begin to talk. Jürgen and I have now been coming to Michigan and spending a week together for how long, would you say?
10 or 11 years.
10 or 11 years, yeah. Jürgen does me the kindness of flying over from Germany so that I don't have to make that trip. And then we use our summer home up here. And in the morning, I usually cook breakfast, and Jürgen always cooks dinner. Then he tries to help me clean up the kitchen. And it always irritates me because I want to clean up the kitchen after he's cooked alone. so we have certain things that we have to remember how we get along with each other. But here's the deal. This is not Andrew Henry leading this podcast, but this is the two of us. And the reason we're doing this is so many times through the years, in having our discussions in the late afternoon, we usually work through the day, and then sometime in the late afternoon, we have a drink together, we begin to talk. Then last night at 8 o'clock, Jürgen serves us dinner. I think it was eight. Wasn't it eight last night?
It was eight, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what did we have?
We had salmon, fish, and salad, of course.
And
fennel and green asparagus.
Yes. And the asparagus was very good at the top end, wasn't it?
It was. It was a bit hard at the lower end.
Yeah. Anyhow, as we talk, I've often wished that I could record our conversations because the interface between America and Germany, between a German pastor and American pastor, between somebody whose life has been spent as a steward of public education, as Jürgen's has, versus someone who spent his entire life limited to the church. We've worked writing together on a couple of books, Elders Reformed and The Grace of Shame. Tonight, I hope we can hit two issues. I don't know if it'll make two separate podcasts or one. But the two issues I'm hoping that we can hit are, number one, the whole issue of Ukraine and the United States and the stability of Europe, its history, our different perspectives. We have probably slightly different perspectives on that, but I find it so helpful to argue with Jürgen and for him to correct me, which he's already taken the opportunity of doing once with a graph that he put together showing me I was wrong in my thinking about whether or not the price of money, interest rates, should be taken into account in COLA, the cost of living adjustment, or I should say this consumer price index. And maybe we can get to that. That was fascinating. So he's corrected me all the time. The second issue is I would like to talk to him a little bit about Wheaton. I have spent much of my life since September, reading primary sources, secondary sources, and writing and thinking carefully about what happens to a small Christian liberal arts college, in this case, the one that my parents and my wife's parents all went to during the years under debate, which were the years of Buzwell, which were the late 30s and early 40s. What is interesting is to talk about education with a man whose life primarily has been to be an educator in the area of both administration and also in economics, although you're currently the dean of which schools, is it?
Law and economics.
Law and economics, economics. And so those are the two issues I'd like to hit. We've already begun to rototill them with each other, and so I just decided, you know, let's turn on the recorder and let's see what happens. So I hope that you'll be patient with us. This is primarily about friendship and iron sharpening iron, and we hope by listening in you might be interested. So we have prayed before we turned on the recorder. So let's start by talking about Ukraine, if you don't mind. Yesterday, I told you that I was ambivalent about us continuing as a country to give money for that war. And I reminded you of what you said before the war ever started, when it looked like it would start, that you had said to me here when we were up here in Michigan, that it was not a good thing for the West to pressure Russia with NATO encroaching on Russia's borders. I remember you saying that. And so I reminded you of that, but you have a different position, and I think that's a good place to jump off. What was your concern then, and how have you changed since then?
My concern 2.5 years ago was mainly that European countries, Germany and France in particular, were speaking in very loud terms against the Russian government, the Putin government. And my hunch was that the Europeans were not going to be able to back up their words. Now, the Ukraine then was on its way, or so it had declared, it was on its way to join the European Union. Everybody at the time thought that was going to be a matter of 20, 25 years because of huge problems with corruption, with non-functioning markets, all these kinds of things that we already observed in the formerly socialist countries in Central and Eastern Europe. When they came into the European Union, it took them about 15 years, I'd say. Some of them even a little longer, Romania, for example. But then those countries received very intensive help to restructure their economies, to reform their economies, both from the International Monetary Fund and from the European Union. 2 years ago, there was friendliness on the European side regarding Ukraine's wish to join the European Union, but the friendliness was in words, not in money, let's say. And at the same time, of course, you will remember there was already a war of Russia against the Ukraine going on. Russia occupied parts of the country in 2014. Russia annexed the Krim Island or peninsula that formerly belonged to the Ukraine. And the European countries, together with the United States, had tried to work out a settlement in that problem, which would basically accept the status quo as of 2014. Now, when we talked about this,
which means ceding the territory to Russia.
Ceding the territory to Russia and also ceding the Crimea to Russia. That would have been hard to swallow for the Ukrainians, but there was not very much of an alternative for them. Now, what has happened since then is, since 2014, Putin's rhetoric became more and more aggressive, saying that the ultimate goal of Russia's politics was to reestablish an empire of the size of the Soviet Union, the former size of the former Soviet Union. And I guess one of the gravest mistakes that Europeans have made between 2014 and 2022 is not to pay very much attention to that rhetoric. Instead, they always thought, as long as we can do business with Putin, he'll be at least
tame
and behaving relatively well. Now, all that changed in the spring of 2022 when Putin marched into the Ukraine, expecting that the Ukrainian government would immediately collapse. You have to realize that the army that he sent into the Ukraine didn't even have winter clothes, not even underwear for winter conditions. But what they brought was their parade uniforms, because they had been told that because Ukrainians are not fully human beings and it's a corrupt regime and they're all Nazis, they will immediately collapse, and within a week the Russian soldiers will hold a parade in Kiev. Now, to the surprise of many,
to my surprise.
Yes. I mean, what I had expected what would happen back in February, March 22 is I thought the Russians were going to win militarily very soon, but then the Ukraine would become a second case of what Afghanistan was for the Russians in the 1980s and early 90s, and eventually they would leave the country and be defeated de facto by
asymmetric warfare.
Yes, guerrilla warfare, terrorist attacks, the same kind of stuff that Afghanistan used in order to drive out the Russian army. And, of course, Afghanistan also used in order to drive out the U.S. Army and all the European allies that were with the U.S. in Afghanistan. Now, that hasn't happened. And part of why it hasn't happened is because, to my own surprise, the European governments very quickly agreed not only to impose sanctions, trade and financial sanctions, on the Russian government and its members, but also supported the war by delivering weapons and financial help to the Ukrainian government. That has certainly changed the quality of the war, and it has also changed my thinking about it. If you listen to what Putin is now saying, it is very clear. What he wants to do is he wants to eliminate what he regards a people that does not have a right to its existence, reestablish the Ukrainian territory as part of Russia, and then pick one of the European countries as the next object of warfare.
Now, you realize at that point that many people are with you until you make that final statement. And I think what we as Americans, those of us who are not just gung-ho for war against Russia, and I would include myself in that group, are somewhat skeptical that this is your irreducibly firm commitment to do right next door what the United States was doing through Vietnam, right? Which is stemming the tide worldwide of the aggressive growth of the Soviet Union then, now Russia and Putin. And so when you say, well, they'll keep expanding, my nose begins to wiggle. And I want you to sort of, you know, argue your case. What makes you actually think that Russia won't be satisfied with the Ukraine?
Well, two things. Number one, that's what the Russians are saying. The goal of their politics is to reestablish what was the Soviet Empire, and that would include the Baltics, three countries which are now part of NATO, by the way. That would include East Germany, Poland, the Czech Republic, the Slovak Republic, and Romania and Bulgaria. All of these countries are close to or established members of NATO. And what Putin, I think, would be gambling on is the idea that if he just grabs a little bit, like the Baltic countries, which, after all, are not very large countries, if he just grabs a little bit of them, NATO will just stay put and say, well, let the Balts go wherever Putin will lead them. Putin will use the same rhetoric that he has used in the Ukrainian case, which is that because the Baltic countries were part of the Soviet Union, there are many people with Russian nationality living there, and the argument he will come up with is that they are being oppressed, they are being killed, and so therefore he has a national duty to take over these countries and help the Russian citizens there. It's exactly the same rhetoric that they used, the Russians used when they marched into the eastern part of the Ukraine in 2014. It's exactly the same rhetoric that they used when they started the war in 2022. And that leads me to my second point. My second point is, if you go back in history and you look at the rhetoric that the Nazi government of Germany used in the late 1930s to justify the occupation first of Austria, then of the Czech Republic, or Czechoslovakia, as it was called at the time, it was exactly the same. There are Germans there. They are being oppressed. We have to save them. Now, in 1938, the British Prime Minister met with Hitler and then came back to London and said, now, look, after all, he's going to be reasonable. We don't have to worry. There's not going to be a war. And so we can relax. We don't have to do anything. My fear is
peace in our time.
Yes, exactly. My fear is that we will be facing a very similar situation.
All right, let me make a comment here. I never stopped thinking about peace in our time with respect to Wheaton College. Because if you think about the driving force behind Wheaton denouncing President Buswell as a racist, it was demanded by a petition by some students of color a couple of years before they finally brought out the report and did the denunciation and the removal of his name from campus. Anyhow, backing out of the whole question of racism, of the whole question of the history of the school, of this, that, and the other thing, what I think is most important to recognize in the church today is the absence of leadership, which understands the fundamental nature of leadership being to protect the people, to protect the nation, to protect the sheep, to protect the sheep from the wolf. Now, if we apply that to international affairs, what you're fundamentally saying is that Putin, being a low-level sort of apparatchik in the KGB before the fall of the whatever you want to call it,
Soviet Union.
Yeah, want to call it the empire. That he now has designs. He takes off his shirt. He's riding a horse, and it's not rational that he is a wolf. That he intends to consume large portions of Eastern Europe, and so. What you're essentially saying is believe him what he says. So what I think in terms of are the leadership of Christian colleges who have students of color just livid, victims, demanding, oppressed, complaining, on and on and on. And to me, the same issue that you had at the beginning of the Second World War that you have now, which is what is a leader to do when it comes to protecting his nation, his people, his college? Is he to appease the aggressors, the wolves, or is he to fight them? And so your fundamental position in this case, and obviously Phil Reich and the president of Wheaton isn't going to say that students of color are his enemies, right?
Yeah. He won't.
But do you think he feels that they are? I'll get back to Europe, but
no, I don't think he feels that they are his enemies. A lot of the culture in colleges today, and I would say both private and public institutions, is that the administration in particular views students as customers, not as people receiving education or young people that have to be trained. And that customer relationship changes the whole thinking about your student body, because all of a sudden your primary concern becomes the inflow of sufficient money. I've seen this happen at Indiana University in the business school already. When I taught then in the early 1990s, that we were told by the administration, you have to view your students as customers. And students then began to view themselves as customers. And as soon as that happens, money takes over. The idea that students could either damage the reputation of the institution, and they told us in the early 90s, the students said, we will tell the Newsweek magazine, when they rate business schools, we will tell them all sorts of bad stories unless we get good grades and the courses will be smooth. And so it changes the nature of higher education, because it becomes a customer and provider relationship instead of a relationship between somebody whose authority comes from competence and somebody who wants to receive training and education and therefore submits to that authority.
Now, I know that in the last couple of years, there's been a paper that's been written by, I want to say, a mathematician couple on the issue of education being, for, you know, the students being the consumers. I don't remember the name of the paper, but I remember reading it. Chris Connell sent it to me. He's a professor of mathematics at IU. Anyhow, I bring that up because, is there any way of reversing that? Once you've gone down the road of servicing your customers as an educational institution, in other words, once you've begun to appease, can you ever return from that?
I don't know. I think it would take a huge effort and a lot of courage to reverse that thinking, because what it would require is to tell the students, look, guys, it is not your place to threaten the institution. It is not your place to, or your role to come up with demands like dethroning somebody from who was an eminent member of the institution in historically. It is your place to sit down and learn and study. That would be almost impossible nowadays, both in Germany and in the United States, because higher education in a democratic country financed with tax money is doomed. The taxpayer wants to see good results, and good results means my kids get out of the institution, graduating with good grades, and find good jobs. That's what they want to get out of higher education. And so when that doesn't happen, because the kids need to study hard and they can receive D's and F's instead of A's and B's, taxpayers are unhappy. And they talk to their the members of parliament and their local politicians and tell them, this is not acceptable. And that's exactly what we see in Germany.
I remember being here with you about 6 years ago when you got a communication from the governor of your province, was it?
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell them about that?
No, you have to remind me of what communication
that was. You received a communication as vice rector that the grades that were given had to go up. You don't remember that?
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, you got an email saying that you had a letter on your desk that when you got back, it had to do with the grading at the university. And it was from, what's the head of your province or whatever it is? I don't know.
The State Ministry of Education.
Yeah.
No, the issue there was a little bit different. The issue was that the government decreed a distribution of grades. And so what they said was you have to grade on a curve. And they also said if somebody has 40% of the questions right, then that person must at least have a passing grade.
But that's exactly what you told me at the time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you and I were just talking about the Chronicle of Higher Ed, talking about the grade inflation that's across the United States. Do you really think it's possible to reverse that? And if not, why not?
Well, for what I just said, because as long as higher education is financed by public or taxpayer money, it has to be catered to the wishes of the parents, ultimately. And you can slow down the movement to grade inflation, but ultimately it's very hard to stop it. Mm. And to reverse it, I don't know. Institutions can innovate and find other ways of providing grades which are not grades, but they serve as grades, such as letters of recommendation and giving people information about the value of a grade. And that's what most institutions in Germany now do. So when somebody graduates from our Department of Economics, the diploma will tell future employers what is the distribution of grades. And so that person comes out, let's say, with a B, and then the information is, well, 60% of all students have B. So that's not all that valuable, in other words.
That's pretty funny.
So, in other words, we can abide by the law, but we can also provide information.
Let's stop a little bit for credentials, because we're talking about leadership of educational institutions, but also leadership of nations, of banks, of NATO, of the U.S. Give us some of your credentials. For instance, what has been your history at the University of Bonn? How big is it? Is it a reputable institution?
In terms of size, it's very comparable to the IU Bloomington campus. Mm-hmm. Somewhere around 35,000 students, I guess, full-time enrolled students. The whole range of subjects from hard sciences all the way to social sciences and arts and letters, a lot of foreign language departments. Bonn doesn't have a music school, so that's a drawback or a disadvantage relative to IU. Bonn has won a competition a few years ago and received a title of University of Excellence, which brought in a lot of money. But basically what that says, depending on the subject, the university always ranks between top 20 and top 10. Mm. Math and economics are the top departments, certainly in Germany, among the top departments in Europe and worldwide.
And you served in what ways administratively?
I was vice rector from 2009 to 2015.
And how many vice rectors are there in the U.S.? Everybody's a vice president.
Yeah, in the German system, there's just one. So there's a rector, there's a vice rector, and then there are other members of the rectorate. And then I was chairman of the economics department since 2017, and this is my sixth and final year as dean of law and economics.
And how many days do you have left?
Oh, about 160.
You got into the corridor here the yes. other day and you said, I have 160, what was it, four?
Yeah, and that's 3 days ago.
Now, this is bragging, and I would not do it if it were me, and Jürgen wouldn't do it if it were him. But I want everybody to know, did they ask you to be the rector?
They did, but I declined.
And how many times did you decline?
Once is enough, because then it was clear.
You were asked twice, because you told me. Why did you decline?
Well, because being a vice rector, I had a lot of opportunities to observe what the life of a rector is, and that was absolutely not what I wanted, because basically you give up your life, you hand it over to the people who organize your calendar, you have meetings and speaking engagements all the time. And that, for me, that would have implied no time to serve the church, and that was one of the main motivations. My kids were already mostly out of the house at that point, but I would have had no time to continue my work as a pastor, and I didn't want that.
The reason I bring this up is that there are many men in the United States today who make themselves out to be leaders and tell Christians who are gullible what government should do, what education should be, all these other things. What I note about these people is that they are only pastors. I have had friends who, you know, were budget director for the state of Indiana under Mike Pence, and Mitch Daniels was a head of municipal finance. Jürgen in his position at University of Bonn and also at Indiana University. And the thing that frustrates me is that Christians are so gullible that they'll listen to any man that says he's smart. And then whatever the smart man says, Christians will begin to parrot, you know, like a bird in a nest in your living room. I love you, honey. I love you, honey. And if you know true leaders who God has called to civil authority, which is Jürgen, which is Brian Bailey, what you realize is the difficulty of governing. So part of what I want people to listen to, what I want you listeners to realize in these conversations, is the great difficulty in making decisions as leaders. So we've been talking about appeasement. We move from the appeasement of Putin to the appeasement by Phil Ryken of some women who got a petition together with some men who had skins of different colors. And I want you to think in terms of leadership being not a science, but an art. But an art that is entirely dependent on wisdom. In connection with this, so you know that Jürgen has been vice rector, was asked to become rector. You know that since then he has been dean of the law and economics school. He's also the head of an institution. Did you continue to be productive during your years as a vice rector in terms of your own discipline?
I was, but to a much lesser extent, because mm-hmm. there was one other thing that came up during this time. I was asked to serve on the Public Finance Council of Portugal. And since I had written many, many papers starting in the 1990s arguing that countries should have independent public finance councils to watch over the health of public finances, and report to Parliament and the public regularly, it was hard for me to turn that request down. If you look at the number of published papers I had since 2019, you will see, obviously, that there was a pretty significant decline. And then since I became dean of law and economics, that has been an even more severe tax on my research time than than before.
You have worked with the Fed. Could you give us some of the places that you have worked? Now, these would be side gigs.
Yeah, I was a research scholar with the St. Louis Fed in early 1987, which actually was great because through that time, I then got the job at Indiana University in the fall of 1987. And then I've spent time as a visiting scholar and advisor to the Federal Reserve Board, to the St. Louis Fed a couple of times, and then other institutions like
Japan,
the IMF, the Bank of Japan, the European Central Bank, of course. Mm-hmm. So quite a number of central banks and public finance institutions like treasuries, finance ministries.
And your specialty is macro and your specialty is currency, am I right?
My specialty was currency back in the 1980s. That changed when the Europeans started talking about introducing a common currency, what now is the euro. At some point, I realized that this would be a lot more important in terms of public finance than in terms of actual currency matters. Mm-hmm. And so I began to work on public finance issues much more than on currency issues.
Have you been hired to be a circus monkey?
What do you mean by that?
Switzerland?
To talk to people or?
You know, the conference in Switzerland. Davos?
Oh, yeah, I was. Now I know what you mean. Yes, I was invited as a scholar and visitor to the World Economic Forum in Davos three times in a row, and that's the max you can get. And Tim is saying as a monkey because that's really what
that's
it
what
is.
That's what you said. It is what
yeah,
you
I
said.
Know. Basically, there what happens is you have a meeting of a whole lot of important business people from all over the world. You have members of government and the big institutions like the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. And, of course, these people need entertainment. And so they invite scientists and scholars and not only economists, also people in medicine and physics and what have you. And your role is to entertain. You have a table full around which you have a lot of people, and you pick up a topic and
well, speaking of entertaining, over the years, there's some stories that I've particularly enjoyed that you've told me. Would you tell them the story about your friend who went over to Russia to tell them how to set up their economy after the fall of the Iron Curtain? The gentleman was from a certain state of the United States, a certain university.
Well, if you're thinking of the person I think of now, there was a group of economists from Harvard and Princeton and Columbia who went over to Russia after the fall of communism to show them or explain to them how to build a capitalistic society. Well, looking back, I think it's very right to say that these people were extremely naive at the time, because they did not realize that a market economy and a capitalistic system is not just a bunch of rules and laws. It requires a whole culture of abiding by law, of being honorable in business. And I think those people who tried and failed to teach capitalism to Russia are at the root of the problems that Russia has today, because it's a failed economy.
My recollection is that you told me that it's broadly recognized across the discipline of economics that they failed. Is that correct?
That depends on whom you ask. If you ask these gentlemen, they will say no. They will say we did a great job. Timothy Snyder, whose books you know, I think, to some extent at least, teaches history at Yale University. Snyder has a great book which came out a couple of years ago called The Road to Unfreedom. Interesting title because it picks up a theme from Hayek, The Road to Serfdom, The Road to Unfreedom. I don't think that's a coincidence. But anyway, Snyder explains what happened in Russia in the early 1990s, and he makes exactly those points also.
And you told me a year ago that this is broadly recognized by economists generally. Now, that's one story. I think you should tell them the story about... is it Helmut Kohl that you were walking with?
Yeah, but
that's a
I don't know what it
story.
Has to do
well,
with
but
the
it's just
Ukraine.
A funny story. I mean, how many people can you talk to who have, you know, I think it's a funny story. You're not willing to humor me.
Well, okay. The Helmut Kohl was the chancellor of Germany, so the head of government of Germany from, I guess, 1983 until 1999. So for a very, very long time. And he was in government when the Berlin Wall fell. Kohl was eventually driven out of government in a not very graceful way. But anyway, he visited the university sometimes after he got out of his chancellorship. And I was invited to meet him together with the rector, and this must have been right around the year 2000. And there were students protesting against his presence and against the university giving him the forum to give a speech. So the halls of the university were packed with students trying to obstruct this event. Now, at some point, Kohl's driver came into the room and he said, "Mr. Chancellor, we cannot go through the main door into the hall because of the student protests." And Kohl said, "Schmidt, how long have you been my driver?" So the gentleman said, 13 years, Herr Bundeskanzler. And Kohl said, "Have I ever gone through a back door in those 13 years? And the driver said, "No, sir." And Kohl said, "Well, then we won't start doing that today." So when he got up from his chair, I realized what a massive man he was.
And how tall are you?
I'm 6'4", something like
that. And how far do your eyebrows stick out from your forehead?
Anyway, he would have been at least 1 foot taller than I am. And I mean, just a massive man. And so he got out of the rector's office, and when he saw the students protesting in the halls, he would just accelerate his steps and accelerate and accelerate. And at some point, the students saw this massive man flying towards them, and they just jumped away, and we ran behind the chancellor and made it into the hall.
Now, that was a good story, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You okay. Enjoyed it. All right.
It should was I ask a good
you,
story.
Should I ask you to tell the story of the bearded woman in Russia?
No. No, no.
Allow me to have a laugh to myself. So those listening, you understand that after 10, 15 years of really very close friendship, I can cherry pick these stories. Now, I want to make a switch here. As you talk about the present situation with Putin, Ukraine, etc., I want to get back to it, but first I want you to explain why you gave me the book Bloodlands. And what the significance of Bloodlands is, that book, for the present situation.
Bloodlands is the story of the Ukraine, Belarus, and parts of Poland between the beginning of, and the end of the, well, the beginning of the 20th century and the 1950s. At that point, through the Russian Revolution, the Ukraine became part of the Soviet Union. And Bloodlands tells you the story of that particular region as the story of Europe's breadbasket, which it basically is. It's the most fertile soil in Europe. It's the most productive area in the production of wheat and other, what do you call that, cereals?
Grains.
Governments from neighboring countries have always had
designs
and desires to become the owners of the Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And so starting in after the Russian Revolution, the Soviets killed thousands and millions of farmers in the Ukraine in order to expropriate the harvests and feed the Russian people, because the Russian economy was completely destroyed. Then, of course, they became the victim of the Nazi occupation with the same goal. Hitler's idea was to use the Ukrainian soil to feed the German population, to basically enslave the Ukrainian farmers and destroy the Ukrainian Jews and use the Ukrainian harvests in order to feed
the war effort.
The war effort and feed the German population. So it was kind of a colonialism, except it wasn't overseas colonialism. It was colonialism next door. And then after the defeat of the German army, the Russians or the Soviets came back, and again, thousands and thousands of Ukrainians being killed because of their efforts to live halfway decent lives and in liberty. So it's called Bloodlands because so much human blood has been shed in that particular territory. Because other powers wanted to acquire it and use the fertility of the soil to feed their own people, which is ultimately what Putin intends to do right now.
Would you have a short excursus into the issue of the concentration camps and the percentage of people who died in Germany versus the blood ones?
Yeah, so the Shoah, as we call it now, or the German efforts to exterminate European Jews, that happened primarily in that particular region called the Bloodlands. And it's very significant for the self-understanding of Germans and for their own understanding of their own history, because after the Nazis came into power in 1933, it became very clear that Germany was not going to be a good place to live for Jews, and so there was massive emigration already during the 1930s. When what the Nazis called the final solution began, the almost industrial extermination of Jewish lives, the people who were victims of that, very, very few of them were from German territory. Most of them were from the Ukraine, Poland, Hungary, Greece, Romania, some of them from France and the Netherlands. But the German Jewish population at that point was very, very small already. And, of course, every human life lost is very precious. But it's not comparable to the masses and masses of Jews that were killed and that hailed from other countries, particularly from the Bloodlands.
Let's get back to Russia and Ukraine, but first, would you please describe the relationship that you have with Toby and his thesis and the Confessing Church, some of the history, your grief over seeing what happened with the church under the Third Reich through your son's paper?
Yeah, so Toby is the older one of my sons, and he got his degree in theology at the University of Heidelberg. He's now a pastor in a small town, not very far from Heidelberg, southern Germany. He wrote his thesis on the theology of the German Lutheran Church during the 1920s and 1930s. And in that context, we got to study the emergence of what became known as the Confessing Church in Germany. And one of...
When you say we got to study, would you describe your relationship with your son? Because many people listening to this have not pursued that sort of relationship with their son.
Well, when I say we studied, is he gave me things to read from his thesis, and that made me study some background and then give him advice, and then he gave me feedback. And so, of course, I can't say that we wrote the thesis together. That would not be.
But I want to make a point just in passing here that when I was growing up, my father, who had a monthly column in Eternity magazine and wrote books, read everything that he published to us as a family and asked for our input. And you may not be an author, but if you build homes, ask your son to tell you what you're doing wrong. If you work on cars, in other words, these sorts of relationships between father and sons, whatever your work is, they must be pursued because they are such a beautiful thing in the relationship of father and son. Would you agree?
Yeah. What I learned from this is that the German Lutheran Church was extremely nationalistic as a church already since the second half of the 19th century. They had thrown their lot entirely after the German emperor. When Germany had lost World War I, the church was completely disoriented because there was no emperor anymore. The kings had all abdicated. The church never supported democracy in the 1920s. One of the more eminent people in the church, Martin Niemöller, who of course was pretty well known also through the 1950s and 60s, Niemöller declared January 31, 1933 as a national Protestant holiday, that being the day when the Nazi government assumed power in Germany. The whole story of the confessing church, which has been, in quotation marks, glorified by history as a movement against the Nazi government, and that's just a misrepresentation of history, in my judgment, for two things. Number one, their conflict with the Nazi government was primarily over the question whether the government had the right to appoint bishops, or that was a privilege of the church. And number two, it turned out in the 1930s that there was a significant number of pastors in the Lutheran Church who were of Jewish origin, came from Jewish families. The Nazis forced them out of their positions as pastors, and the confessing church never made a big deal out of that, which is the main reason, as I understand it, that both Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Karl Barth eventually broke with the confessing church, because they had firmer and better commitments.
Since you've referred to Niemöller, you have not told people why they know that name. Can you tell them? Do you remember his statement? So at the Holocaust Museum, the statement is on the wall, and he said it a number of times in a number of different ways, so you're going to find different versions of this. But one of the versions is, first they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I wasn't a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. He ended up, after the end of World War II, basically repenting, did he not?
No.
Seriously?
No. No. Niemöller had a leadership position in the confessing church, and he actually met with Hitler personally a couple of times, and apparently succeeded in enraging Hitler because he was not sufficiently deferent, and because he insisted that the church, that the state, had no right to interfere with church affairs such as the appointment of bishops. Now, Niemöller was arrested eventually in the late 1930s and put into a prison camp. But from all we know, it was a fairly nice treatment as far as prison camps go. So he could receive visitors. He could obtain books to read. He could correspond with people.
Let me stop you for a second, because if you talk about Niemöller being opposed to the government taking over the church's authority, okay, everybody who's reformed is going to say, well, yeah, that was the same conflict between Calvin and the city fathers of Geneva.
Yes and no. Yes and no, because Calvin's orientation at that point already was Presbyterian. There was a tradition that the church, the city administration, at least thought they had a right to appoint church leadership. The situation in Germany, I think, from the beginning was very different, because after the Reformation, the Lutheran church became a state church in the German context, which means, of course, Germany was split into a lot of different kingdoms and dukedoms and fiefdoms, but every fief and every king was the head of his state's local church.
The church, yeah.
And and so the tradition, the tradition would have been much, much firmer and more established that the political authority is the head of the church, and as head of the church, appoints bishops.
Well, what I think is interesting about this is that people would conflate the two and think that the same principle was at stake with Niemöller and Calvin. The problem is that the essence of Calvin's opposition was not being able to limit and to bar people from the Lord's Supper. In other words, the sacraments. It's one thing to say that you as a government can't appoint our bishops and can't rule our important people. It's another thing to say, as a pastor standing here at the Lord's Supper, I cannot enforce the discipline of 1 Corinthians 5. And so I want to make that clear, that even though it sounds similar, it's actually categorically different. Calvin was defending the ability to rule the sacraments of Christ's church. And that's why twice he ended up having to leave Geneva. Whereas Niemöller was the son of a Lutheran minister, and I think it would be fair to say was protecting the prerogatives of the ecclesiastical authorities. And there's a world.
Yes, and the idea of fencing the table would have been completely,
and so
would
now,
have completely disappeared from
so
the
Lutheran
church.
And so now would you move into that? You know, would you explain the origin of the Free Church movement in Germany?
Well, it's precisely that point that in the Lutheran Church in the 19th century, it had become common that anybody could partake in the Lord's Supper. There was a particular group of Christian men in a city called Wuppertal, not very far from Cologne, who were very unhappy about that, because they had studied the Bible, they knew 1 Corinthians, and they knew that it was not appropriate for a man who commits adultery, or for a man who is known to steal from his customers and so on, to partake in the Lord's Supper. And so they asked their Lutheran pastor, would it be okay to celebrate the Lord's Supper at home or separate from the rest of the community with a group of people that we know are truly believers? And the pastor said no. And so that became the issue over which free evangelical churches in Germany were first founded in the 1850s. The date is significant because Germany had a constitution for the first time in 1848, and that constitution gave people the right of religious freedom, in other words, the right to form churches and religious associations.
Let's jump back now, because part of what we've been describing is the interface between ecclesiastical and secular authorities and the nature of leadership. And you said at the very beginning of this conversation that Putin will not stop at Ukraine. And then you established, you know, the Baltics and the various countries, Poland. Would you explain to us why you think he won't stop with Poland?
Well, first of all, there's a simple geographical reason. East Germany was part of the Soviet Empire. So if he wants to reestablish that, East Germany will have to be part of it. But secondly, and I think that's actually the more important issue, it's an issue of leadership. For the past 50 years, if you look at NATO, the leadership in NATO has always come from the United States, because Europeans were too busy quarreling among themselves, having all sorts of political issues.
So the U.S. was the dad in the room.
The U.S. was, yeah, the big brother and the dad and the one willing to provide the resources. I have said for the past 25 years at least that one of the things which are not tenable in U.S.-European relations is that Europeans have spent a lot of time and a lot of money expanding their social welfare systems and have not spent money on defense. And
or infrastructure.
Well, that's a different issue.
Yeah, but you taught me that when I was in Germany, because
yes,
we were perpetually driving in 35 kilometer per hour. It was mind-numbing, and they'd been going on for years. Would you explain that to them?
No, not at this point. All right. All right. No, because the other issue I think is more important right now. Infrastructure is an internal issue, but when it comes to leadership in NATO, that's what supposedly keeps the whole thing together. Now, the point that I'm making is that European governments, and Germany in particular, have used every penny they could find of public money to increase welfare spending. Defense has become completely neglected, to the point that now when you look at the German army, everybody knows that planes are not flying, tanks are not driving, guns are not shooting. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's really ridiculous. And here comes 2022, February, and the German chancellor says, this is a turnaround in history, Zeitenwende. And we will make 100 billion euros available for defense. But nothing has happened since then. They have treated, and this goes for, I think, all European governments, they have treated the Ukrainian war as if it was going to be over in 2 weeks, just like Putin, in a way. Nobody prepared themselves for a war that goes on and goes on. And to this point, now the German government proudly says, but we have plans to build factories for ammunition. Plans. And, you know, one way of seriously reading the Russian strategy is that Putin expects that Europeans will deliver so much of their ammunition and equipment to the Ukraine that when he's done with the Ukraine, there will be very little left for defense in Europe. Now, where is that going to come from? If not from the United States, I don't know. That's the current situation there. And the gravest problem, I think, is a lack of leadership. There's not sufficient leadership from the U.S. government. And from all we can see, if Mr. Trump is reelected, he will not provide leadership to NATO because he keeps talking about NATO being a nuisance and how he's going to deliver NATO members that don't pay up to the Russian government. And you've heard all these things. And at the same time, who is going to lead in Europe? Certainly not the current German government. Certainly not the current French government. And the Brits have declared that they are more interested in the Pacific Ocean than in the Atlantic Ocean. So all I can say is when I look at this situation, I'm scared for the sake of my children.
So what are we currently at? $110 billion, $120 billion that we as a country alone have put into you guys? Do you really think that we can continue to prop you guys up?
No, you can already see that the Ukrainian support program that the Biden administration is bringing to Congress tomorrow foresees that the financing will be on the basis of a loan to the Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And
that's a joke.
Well, no, it's not a joke. What it means is that Europe will foot the bill.
Yeah, but when has because the United States ever demanded repayment of loans?
A lot of times. All the time. What do you mean?
Well, I would expect that that's actually something that's a wink-wink situation.
No. This is an international loan, and international loans tend to be enforced.
Well, I'm old enough to remember you talking about Greece.
But the game that the
year... Did you hear what I just said?
Yeah.
Do you remember what you said to me about Greece when everybody was talking about the loans to Greece to prop it up?
But that's a very similar point. Greece is suffering and will be suffering for the next at least one generation, if not two, suffering under the need of repaying all those loans, which were declared as being help, but it's expropriation of the country. And what I told you at the time was the economically efficient solution would have been to allow Greece to go bankrupt, because at that point, the country would have defaulted mostly on private loans, not on government loans. Mm-hmm. But the game that the Biden administration is playing now, I think, is basically this. They are lending money to the Ukraine. They will insist that the Ukraine pays back. The Ukraine will not be able to pay back, and so the EU will pay.
Now, at this point, I would like you to say what, in one of your meetings with these leaders of the nations, what they said to you about the Second World War in Germany. In other words, when you talk about the EU, how do you separate Germany from the EU? How do you separate the EU paying it back from Germany paying it back? You remember what I'm talking about, where the guy said to you, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, but of course, Germany traditionally was the largest and most powerful economy in the European Union. That's rapidly changing, by the way. 10 years from now, that will definitely not be the case. And
Italy will be above you, right?
Italy already is, depending on how you look at it. But if you think about the percentage of trains arriving in time Italy is way better than Germany. And that tells you something about infrastructure. but seriously,
I was making a joke and you're flooring me. Are you serious?
Yes.
Is that absolutely. Because just of styles and fashion? What does Italy have to make?
Oh, they have lots of things. The north of Italy is very industrialized.
Seriously.
And
because when you read about the richest people in the world, it's all fashion.
Yeah, that's where the money is. But if you look at cities like Milan, Turin, there's a lot of good industry there. Hmm. And very productive.
So what's happened to Germany?
What's happening to Germany is that this started already 12 years ago when the Merkel government decided to get out of nuclear energy. The whole energy policy in Germany is, it's basically economic suicide. Energy is becoming ever more expensive. As a result of that, the prospects for economic growth are minimal. And the government fools themselves saying, oh, this is just a bad state of the business cycle. It's not a bad state of the business cycle. That is the new trend of the German economy, which is maybe 0.1% of growth. That's what we're currently looking at. And so other countries are rapidly overtaking Germany. Now, coming back to the other issue, it used to be the common understanding in the European Union that when a large bill comes up, the Germans take it and pay for it because Germany was the most powerful economy in the Union and the Germans had lost the war. And so take those two arguments together, it's hard to beat them.
Let's go back to Putin. Why do you think that he will not stop with Poland, but will then go to Germany? Is it just East Germany, or do you have a basic suspicion? I mean, when I explain to people, I explain to them the U.S. is an empire. It's not a nation.
Well, I would recommend everybody to read Timothy Snyder's book on that. And the basic argument he makes is that the logic of a regime like Putin's at some point dictates that you become more and more aggressive to the outside in order to keep your own people quiet. Because after all, what do they have? Economic conditions are lousy. Freedom doesn't exist anymore. So the only thing to persuade them to keep quiet is to tell them we have all these enemies and we have to beat them and overcome them and reestablish our former glory. That was the logic of the Nazi regime, and it is the logic of the current Russian regime. There is no stopping, because stopping would make people ask the question, so what did we suffer for? And there is no answer.
And that was fundamental to the Russian Revolution, the Tsar, and their whole notion of the glory of Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And starting to engage in the world wars as a method of consolidating and unifying the nation was just central to Nicholas and to the end of the White Russians. In other words, when it comes to nationalism, war has utility in unifying the nation.
The real issue in Russia today is that democracy, if it ever existed, has been completely destroyed. Democracy means there is a reliable principle of how you go from this government to the next. Russia doesn't have that principle anymore. The principle is Putin will be in power forever. And if he's still alive in, what is it, 2033 or 4, his current secured time in office, he will have parliament pass a law that he can go for another 20 years. But what that means is there is no established way of inaugurating a new government other than taking up arms and killing each other. And aggression to the outside is a way
of unifying.
Of, well, not even unifying, but of keeping people from asking questions and taking up arms.
When Trump first came in, you and I were here, and you said that Trump was right in demanding that the European Union began to take on the responsibility of NATO. You remember that?
Yes.
So now you've...
And it's... He's, so that's still correct.
What do you have to say about Trump in the U.S. and Biden? I know you're not an expert.
Well, first of all, I would still emphasize the same point. And I said that earlier, Europeans have neglected the responsibility of their own defense for far too long. Now, what we've seen in the last 2 years is Europeans have started to spend more money on defense. But to what extent they really want to maintain that, that's a very open question. And if I just look at Germany, the German government is struggling to fulfill all the promises in climate policy and social policy now that they have to increase defense spending. My expectation would be that when President Trump comes back into office, that he will keep repeating the same point. But I hope he will do that with more leadership than what he recently said in the press conference when he said, well, I'll just, anybody who doesn't pay up, I'll tell Putin you can go in there. Because that undermines the U.S. government's credibility itself. That leadership, I think, would have to include the recognition that you can't change these things within 4 weeks. It takes time. The Biden administration has been much, much weaker in insisting on that point, as far as I can see, which is why the Europeans love Biden. You know, he does step on their toes and tell them, you have to take more responsibility for your own defense. And so it will be a struggle. President Trump's first administration, I think, hasn't been all that bad in terms of foreign policy. I mean, he didn't start a war. Everybody in Europe predicted when he came into power, it'll take 2 weeks and the world will be on fire. No, that didn't happen. His rhetoric was often unconventional, let's say, telling people that he has a bigger one than the guy in North Korea. He did say that, remember?
I don't even remember that.
But the results were not all so bad. And like I said, if he...
Did he really say that?
Oh, yes. He said that. about the North Korean government and their nuclear threats. Let's just hope that he has good counselors. The trouble is, President Biden is not a person exerting the kind of leadership that NATO and Europe at this point would need. And that's deplorable. But I want to make another point in relation to that. You said earlier you're tired of thinking that the U.S. keeps sending money to the Ukraine and to the European Union. As economists, we always ask, so what's the alternative? And up to now, I'm convinced that the alternative will eventually turn out to be more expensive by dimensions to the United States. And for two reasons. One is, if the U.S. pulls out of the Ukraine and says, Europeans, you're on your own, they will be on their own and shut their borders vis-a-vis the United States. And the same will be true for Japan, Taiwan, Australia. They will all look at NATO and say, if the U.S. is not reliable there, will they come to our defense when push comes to shove? And what they'll do is they'll say, forget the U.S. We will do our own clubs in economic terms, in military terms. And the U.S. will find itself without many friends and without trading partners. And it will be very costly.
Well, I want to end this soon and then come back to other subjects, but I hear you. Now, if you don't mind, can you prognosticate a little bit about Israel and the Palestinians?
Oh, I heard somebody say the other day, the trouble with prognostication is that it relates to the future.
All right, then. Just talk about the present.
I think the situation right now obviously is terrible. But it's not clear what the alternative is there. I think the whole idea of two states is a failure from the beginning.
I see. We haven't talked about this, but I agree with you totally.
And my main reason for thinking that is, if you have two states, Israel as it is, and then the Palestinian state, the Palestinian state will always be economically dependent on support from neighboring countries, countries like Russia, Iran. And by implication, they will always be stuffed with arms against Israel. Mm-hmm. And so in my mind, what would have to happen is to put Israel and Palestine under the same roof, have a common government that has the monopoly on armed forces, and make sure that Palestine becomes a viable country economically, so that they don't have to depend on thugs.
But do you think Israel has any desire to see that eventuality?
I don't think they have a desire to see that at this point. Mm-hmm. But I think we have gotten ourselves into a dead end by always insisting on two states, two states, two states. Because that's, in my mind, that's a failure from the beginning.
Well, my guest has been how do we say this? Herr, Doctor, Professor, Reverend. How do you say that?
No, you go by logic. Reverend, Reverend professor,
professor,
Doctor.
Doctor.
And it's then, very simple.
Isn't it Herr, too?
Herr is what I have on my head.
Anyhow, thank you very much. We will promise to record again during our time up here. We're going to be up here through next Thursday, which would be, 19, 20, 21,
20, 25th?
25th, yes. Yeah, the 25th. Yep. And if you have any questions or anything you'd like for us to discuss or anything you want to ask Jürgen, because he's the expert, he always says to me, I am the faultless human being.
I never say that.
That's a quote of Chesterton that we always kid each other over. If you have questions or suggestions, please send them to me at tbbaily@gmail.com. And so we wish you a good day. Hope you enjoyed it. Bye-bye.
Out of Our Minds is brought to you by New Geneva Academy. If you are interested in training for the pastorate or eldership, visit newgenevaacademy.com for more information.